error to say, I shouldn't be using commercial about the Harvard Public Sampling System. The Harvard Public Sampling System is the Harvard Alumni Club in the Bay Area, and we have Gotham here, who is our past president here, as of a month ago. And we have lots of events. This is just one, hopefully, one of our many events on the environment. Our next one is going to be on August 24th, and it's going to be on climate change and global health. So we're still working on this logistical details, so please come to the Harvard Club website. It should be up by the end of this week, so it'll be on the 24th. And then we just announced a end event on Shakespeare at Benton Beach, which will be on September 9th. This is the event that is sold out each year for the last 5 years. So if you want to go, sign up today. And now it's my turn. Eric Corey Free. Actually, I heard about Eric through Donna's group, I think the first alumni club of San Francisco. Eric is the principal of Organic Architects, and he is an architect, and Organic Architecture is an architecture firm, but they also do research, and it's the same thing. They also publish on green design, sustainable design. He teaches sustainable design right here in this very building. And he writes mostly songs for the greenerbuildings.com. Here's Eric.
Thanks. It's an honor to be here tonight, and especially given this overwhelming turnout. I'd also like to thank, before I forget, because I'm notorious for doing that, is thank UC Berkeley for giving us the room. And just so you know, in lieu of rent, they're making me clean up the tables afterwards. So keep that in mind. Tonight, I'm going to use this opportunity to talk to you about something that I've spent the last 15 years working on, and that I feel obviously is very important. But first, a little bit about myself. I'm an architect, and I discovered about 5 or 6 years ago that I started doing things that were really outside of architecture, things that weren't technically design, but things that interested me and things that I felt were important. And I had a bit of an epiphany, which was that whereas I always thought that architecture was the end in itself, I realized that really it's just a means to an end, and that greater end is that our responsibility, each of us, is to make the world a better place. And that was how I justified doing all these things that were taking me away from the office and taking me away from billable clients and stressing out my staff and things like that. So we entered this, I guess about 9 years ago, with this intention that there should be as many types and styles as there are individuals, that each building should be unique, like a snowflake, and that to that end, we have an individual responsibility to question what are we putting into the building and ultimately where did it come from. So I'd like to start off with a quote from Bucky Fuller. For those of you who don't know who Buckminster Fuller was, he was a certified genius, and given that this is the Harvard Club. And 50 years ago he wrote dozens and dozens of books, and he actually figured out how to house, clothe, and feed everybody on the planet. He actually did the math and then decided to show his work to everybody. And they said, what a lunatic. And now, 50 years later, we're finally realizing, wait, maybe there's something to what he was saying. And he defined sustainability as the effective applications of the principles of science to the conscious design of our total environment in order to help make the Earth's finite resources, not infinite, but finite resources meet the needs of all of humanity. And that's not just Americans, and it's not just white people, but all of humanity, without disrupting the ecological processes of the planet. And this was over 50 years ago. 46? 50 years later, the United Nations decided to find their own term of sustainability, and they did it as developing the needs of the present without sacrificing the needs of our future. It's wonderfully succinct, isn't it? So being that you're in school tonight, and being that I'm a professor, I always resort to professor mode. So we're going to define a few terms first to put things into context. The first one is that you should know what eco means. Eco comes from the Greek oikos, which means house. So in this case, economy would be house management, and ecology would be house knowledge. And it's amazing how rarely we often link those two words, economy and ecology. But I assure you, they are indeed linked. And in this case, the house, of course, is, you know, the big one, Earth. And if you start thinking in those terms, as the Earth is our house, and that what kind of housekeepers are we, maybe you would start to question some of your behavior. And the reason I bring this up is because in the last 100 years, a lot of really bad stuff has happened. We've lost 50% of our wetlands, 50% of our forests, 70% of our fisheries, all gone. My grandfather just passed away at 95, so all of this devastation happened in his lifetime. Unfortunately, the devastation is not going away. If you look at all the projections, it's actually about to get much worse. The red line is where we are now. The biggest part of that chart on the right is the developing countries, specifically China and India. This chart that you probably can't read, this is a list of, quote, very serious environmental concerns that normal people have. Not scientists, but normal people, you know, you. And there shouldn't be any surprise to you. Water pollution, destruction of the ozone layer, destruction of the rainforest, blah, 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 blah. And these gray bars represent consumers' interest in all things green and sustainable. And then the black bars indicate the corporate response to that demand. And for those of you that have ever taken an economics class, that difference is really what we call an untapped market. And then the chart on the right, those are organic industry sales trends going up, up, up. But you don't need any of this data for me to tell you that. If you just look on the newsstand, surely it's no secret, right? Dozens of magazines every month pointing out what we already know. And it's not just these kind of obscure hippie magazines like Mother Jones either, is it? Now there are whole magazines dedicated to this entire life cycle. Magazines like Plenty. But then it's not even just those either, right? You like that? But it's even not just those, because last year Time Magazine does 52 issues a year. 32 of their 52 issues have to deal with the environment. Can anyone really feign ignorance anymore? Can anyone say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know? And then, my head almost fell off when I saw this a few months ago. So when Vanity Fair dedicates an entire issue to green, when Oprah Winfrey dedicates a whole episode to green, surely it's hit the tipping point, right? Are any of you really unaware that there's an issue with the environment? So what does any of this have to do with buildings? I'm an architect, right? So why am I talking about this? Why is this important? Well, unfortunately, that has a lot to do with buildings, because architects are the worst offenders of them all. Buildings consume more than any other industry. In terms of carbon emissions, buildings are responsible for 45% of the carbon emissions, more than cars. And we're always pointing at the auto industry, you jerks. But in fact, it turns out that architects and contractors are in a position to affect great change on our environment. And so far, it's all been negative. But that's starting to change. Buildings of the world consume 40% of the world's energy and resources. 25% of our wood, 17% of our water all go into buildings. The United States, which is about 4.5% of the world's population, consumes 36% of the world's energy, 65% of the world's electricity, so on and so forth. But maybe it's better to show you this way. The United States is 4.5% of the world's population. And that 4.5% is using 34% of the world's energy. And that 4.5% is using 65% of the world's electricity. And that 4.5% is producing 30% of the greenhouse gas emissions. How can that possibly continue? Especially as China and India now are growing in population by leaps and bounds. This was polar ice caps in 1979, and this is it today. So I'm not saying it is to scare you. I'm just saying this to put things in context. this is the end of the guilt trip. Now we can actually talk about what we can do to change that. So they did a poll a few years ago, and they asked a bunch of designers, hey, do you think you have a responsibility to offer sustainability to your clients? And 83% said, oh, yeah, sure, But only 37% actually do. And frankly, I think 20% of those 37% are lying, because if you look, I don't really see as much of it happening as it should. And their chief indicator is they go, oh, we don't have enough information. But you've already seen all the data, and you've already seen the magazines, and you've already seen all those other things. How can they really say that anymore? So I firmly believe that each snowflake in the avalanche pleads not guilty, and that each of us so far has been a snowflake, a unique and wonderful snowflake. But if you think back, there was a man named Vitruvius, and in 27 BC, he wrote the 10 Books of Architecture. It's required reading for all architecture students. And in it, he said that architecture must have firmness, commodity, and delight. Or in today's modern terms, be functional, be aesthetically pleasing, and then be responsible. And responsible is a good word. Responsible is the word we use with our clients, because responsible is something that they understand. Clients don't understand sustainable, and they don't understand ecological. But they understand responsible. They pick their kids up at soccer practice, they're responsible. Occasionally they pay their architect's bills, and they're responsible. So they understand that. So that's the word that we use with them. Guilt is no way to sell environmentalism. And we do this because in the near future, hopefully near future, the word green architect will be redundant. In the near future, saying green architect will be like saying structurally sound building. That will sound silly. It'll be like saying fast sports car. Green building? Well, of course it's a green building. All buildings are green, aren't they? And what evidence do we have of this? 10 years ago, $53 billion spent towards green building. 5 years ago, $200 billion. Today, $800 billion. And the trend is rising. So given all that I've just said, this extensive environmental damage in the last 100 years, this untapped market that says they want green solutions, that architects actually admit that they're responsible for it and want to provide it, given all of that, what is the problem? Why isn't it catching on as much as it should? And we really identify two problems. The first one is that most designers don't know how to explain it to their clients. They think they do, but they don't, and then when they get to it, they chicken out. And this is something that I hear over and over again. So I'm going to give you the crash course of how we explain it to our contractors and our clients. The first thing you need to understand is that every material, every product, everything has what we call a life cycle. That had a life before, and when you're done with it, it has a life after. And some parts of that are these things called embodied energy. These tables that are in front of you, they have energy embodied into it. They're not plugged into the wall, but I assure you that energy went into them. Someone had to design them, someone had to pull the materials together, someone had to manufacture them, someone had to schlep them here into this room, and occasionally somebody cleans them. And all of that is embodied into the design of the product. The next thing you need to realize are what we call byproducts. And byproducts typically have this negative connotation. But byproducts are the things that are left over, both good or bad, caused from this life cycle, this extraction, manufacture, transport, installation. And typically, they're things that we're too dumb to know how to use. And then when we don't know how to use them, we end up calling them waste. And waste is this man-made label. It's something that we say to make ourselves feel better to describe all the byproducts that typically we throw away, wherever away is. Well, you all know where away is. It's south of 101. You drive past it on the way to Candlestick Park, right? That's away. If you roll your windows down, you can smell it. I'm, of course, talking about Candlestick. No, I'm talking about the dump. So the thing that you all have to immediately understand from today forward is there's no such thing as waste. Nature doesn't have waste. Nature doesn't even recycle. Nature absorbs everything and then regenerates it back in endless loops of nutrients. So going back to this notion of life cycle is looking at any material, any product, anything from extraction, manufacture, transport, all the stuff that came before, through its use, and then what happens to it when we're done with it. And graphically, that looks like this. I know it's overwhelming, I'm sorry, but I'll walk you through it. First, everything starts out in some raw material form, right? And then goes through some supply chain process, manufacturing, into delivery and receiving, and through installation. And all of that happens before you even get it. Then we move into use. But even within the realm of use, the thing has to be powered, either by batteries or plugged in or pedaled or something, and then it has to be maintained, either it has to be cleaned or the filters need to be changed or something else. And all of this adds to the impact that it has. And then lastly, when we're done with it, is this idea of disposable, when we throw it, quote, away. And when we throw it away, can we reuse it for something else? Can we repair it? Or if we do throw it away, is it biodegradable and will it feed the soil? And the answer is usually no. Usually it just seeps chemicals into the soil and then we drink it and then we're slowly killing ourselves. But at each of these stages, energy goes in and energy is lost. Just normal part of physics, entropy, right? So at each of these phases, because of that, byproducts go in and byproducts are given off, and often byproducts are lost. And we call this waste. And a lot of people call this industry. But since you now know there's no such thing as waste, right? That's your new lesson of the day. Then how do we change that? As designers, we're really trained to just focus on use. That's what we're really good at. Oh, look how it looks, and God, I wonder if I can cut it, and can I paint it, and you know, I'll shine a light on it. And that's what we're really trained to do. But we really need to think about this entire life cycle, and what came before, and what's going to come after, and how that can inspire better designs. We need to understand this life cycle better for all the materials that we use, and at least ask the questions. And we might not even like the answers to the questions, but at least we're asking them. So even just looking at this chart, think about the things that you use on a daily basis. And think about what happened to them before you got them, and what's going to happen to them after, and how that might affect some of your decision making. Anytime these byproducts are left unused, and we throw them away, this is what we call cradle to grave. And I'm trying to sound ominous here, right? Grave, like death. You scared? And this cradle to grave model is what we've been following for decades. And again, a lot of people call this industry. And anytime we think in this term of disposal or throwing something away, this is again cradle to grave. And again, some people call this industry. But if we can change our thinking and understand that there's no such thing as waste, and understand that we have a reuse and a life cycle to adhere to, then we call this cradle to cradle, birth to rebirth, ad infinitum. This is an example of cradle-to-cradle thinking. This is the mirror chair by Herman Miller, and it's based on the Aeron chair, which you probably all have in your offices, right? But this one, instead of being made of plastic and made of oil, this plastic is made of corn. So if you were to throw this chair in the dump, it would actually feed the soil and make the grass grow rather than pollute it. But it's not designed to be thrown away because it comes apart in 15 minutes, and it's 96% recyclable. And by recyclable, I don't mean downcyclable. I mean recyclable. You send it back to Herman Miller, and they make more mirror chairs. And they can sustain that over and over and over again. That's an example of, a simplified example of cradle-to-cradle thinking. How then could you do that to an entire building? And that's what we're working on now. The second problem with environmentalism is that it's not a black and white issue. And people love black and white issues, don't they? Because that's what we're good at. Democrat versus Republican, right? And this problem is compounded further by the fact that we have so many different options and so many different priorities. When you go to the grocery store, you're confronted with this because people say, hey, paper or plastic? And suddenly you're in this moral quandary, aren't you? You're wondering, God, well, paper comes from trees, and that's bad, right? I shouldn't cut down trees, but it's natural. But then plastic I can recycle, but it's made of oil, and so what do I do? And what's the right answer? Anybody know? Yeah, bring your own damn bag is right. That's correct. So, well, this doesn't end with just paper or plastic. This goes through all elements of the building industry. When we say, do we pick the bamboo that grew from 3,000 miles away in China but was sustainably harvested? Or do we pick the wood that came from 20 miles away? Do we pick something that was recycled or something that's recyclable? Do we pick something that's energy efficient, or do we pick something that's non-toxic? So let me give you an example. Is concrete a green material? Does anybody know? Concrete. Concrete? Is it green? He's saying yes. What are you saying? Don't cheat now. Well, let's analyze this life cycle of concrete, right? On the good side, it's all natural. cement, sand, water, stone. It's technically recyclable, incredibly durable, technically doesn't off-gas anything, completely inert. You don't need to finish it, you could leave it bare. So that's all. That sounds really good. But on the other side, its chief ingredient, Portland cement, is mined out of the earth, it's heated to 5,000 degrees and releases an immense amount of carbon dioxide, which is the greenhouse gas. So suddenly that's bad. So when you say it's concrete a green material, well, yeah, kind of. Yes and no? And this happens with every material. So at best, environmentalism is really about shades of gray, or if you want to be a smart-ass, shades of green. And how then can you change this argument and make environmentalism appear as a black and white issue so that way people can understand it? So the funniest and simplest example I have is actually has to do with tuna fish. And you remember a few years ago when they discovered the dolphins were being caught up in the tuna nets? And then everybody said, don't buy tuna. Dolphins are dying. Flipper's dying. Don't buy tuna. And Flipper's cute, and we can't have that. And although nobody ever came to the aid of the poor tuna, the dolphin sure had a... the dolphin really had a strong showing of support because the industry changed overnight. And it took a very complex issue, marine fisheries and agriculture and shipping and retail and all that other stuff, and simplified it to its bare essence. Flipper is dying, don't buy tuna. And tuna sales plummeted. And now, you can't buy tuna that's not dolphin safe. Certainly not tuna safe. So then going back to our example of concrete, if the one problem with concrete is this notion of Portland cement, what if we use something else? The ancient Romans discovered that if you take fly ash and put that into the mix, that it actually makes the concrete stronger. What is fly ash? Good question. I'll give you your checks later. Fly ash is this byproduct from the coal industry. 85% of the electricity produced in this country comes from the burning of coal. And what's left over is this nasty stuff called fly ash. And normally we dump fly ash in the ocean. The chief chemical makeup of fly ash is mercury. So if any of you are wondering where the mercury is getting into our fish, it's not the fish's fault. It's because we're dumping fly ash in the ocean. And it's also being released in the air, and then it gets in the clouds, and then it rains. And then we eat the fish, and then we have high mercury levels. But that's another story. But what if we took this nasty fly ash and then put it into our concrete? Killed two birds with one stone, right? For lack of a better word. So whenever we explain this to our clients, we break it down into three levels of financial commitment. Finishes, systems, and structure. And the reason we do that is because they really do have different levels of financing involved. The first one, finishes, is the easy one. We just play the substitution game. The clients don't ask for toxic floors, and they don't ask for toxic paints. They ask for floors and paints. And we've been giving them toxic floors and paints. And most of them don't know. So what we do is a simple trick is we don't tell them. And we just automatically substitute all those things. And we only show them green finishes. And people have this lovely ability to only pick what's in front of them. So we take advantage of that. The second one is systems. And the reason that systems have their own level of financial commitment is because they do bear usually some upfront costs, such as solar panels. And it's not a very fair comparison when you compare a building without solar panels to a building with solar panels. And then people say, green buildings are more expensive. But in truth, the solar panels start paying for themselves from day one. And then you have a building that doesn't produce energy and then one that is producing energy. So how is that a fair comparison? So we always talk in terms of their return on investment. So whenever we look at any of these upfront systems, we immediately calculate that the net cost to our client will be zero. And it might take 6 years to do that. It might take 10 years to do that. But that's how we do it. And then lastly is structure. And the reason structure is this new level of commitment is because it's a big difference to say to a client, well, instead of 2x4s for your walls, we're going to use, 26-inch thick straw bale. And they go, what? And when the average size lot in San Francisco is 25 feet wide, suddenly that makes a big difference and does require a bit of a commitment from your client and certainly a leap of faith. So the way we're able to handle this and the way we're able to make all these shades of green or shades of gray into black and white arguments is we've set priorities. And these priorities help me on a daily basis make decisions of what to choose. So when I'm confronted with two disparate decisions to make, first and foremost I say, well, let's not kill our clients. And to me, that happens to be a good priority. It's also a good business model. So above anything else, we pick the natural non-toxic thing first, if we can. And then next, we pick something with low embodied energy. Next, we pick something sustainably harvested. And what I tell other architects when I give them this list is that they should make their own decisions and make their own priorities. I just happen to think not killing people is kind of a good one. So once we do that, we then establish new goals for the project and goals that we believe are important. And these, of course, are in addition to the normal goals of, well, getting the building on budget and getting the building on schedule. And I guess also building something insanely beautiful. But these goals include improving the indoor air quality, building a building that doesn't waste water, building a building that conserves or at least produces energy, building a building that conserves our materials, and lastly is what we call community building. And that's the most vague and one that I struggle with on a daily basis. But for example, we're doing a two-unit building in Pichero Hill, and we're looking for ways to build community and foster community in that. So the way we're doing it is we're building this outdoor courtyard that both of the units front to. And the idea would be that, well, maybe once a week or once a month, both tenants go and have a dinner there together. And if we build community. And maybe once a month, they give it out to some local nonprofit and let them use the space for a meeting. And that would foster community. So there's things like that. And then there's kind of goofy things that we have clients do, like put a bench out front for people to sit on as they walk by. Or put a dog dish out front for the homeless people to drink, I guess. Or we have one client now that's putting out an art board, and they've committed to changing the poster in it every few weeks when they get bored of it. So that way they're decorating their community. So there's things like that that are still undefined for me, but still worth mentioning. So there are two remaining obstacles, and I get these confronted all the time. The first one is that beauty is not exclusive of sustainability. They're not at all connected. But yet people think they do. They, when they hear green building, they think it's going to look like a mud hut or a rice cake or something like that. And I don't understand that argument. And the odds are, since you are residents of California, that you've probably been in a green building and not known it. Haha. And I encountered it even from people within the profession. After we developed the sustainable design curriculum in the Academy of Art and then here at Berkeley, we took it to other schools and we said, here, take it. And one of the leading architecture schools that will remain nameless said, oh, no, we're not interested in sustainability. We're a design school. But I said, I don't understand. I thought I heard him wrong. And I said, I don't understand. He said, well, we're interested in design. We're not interested in sustainability. As if you'd have to give up one to have the other. And he's consequently, as dean, has been fired. Now they have a new one coming in. So the second obstacle is that cost is not tied to green materials. Because how can you possibly compare the two? When people say, well, non-toxic paint costs more. Oh, really? Well, how much are they charging you for the chemicals that are giving you cancer? Is that part of your cost? What is the business case that you could possibly make for using toxic materials in a building? What is the business case you can possibly make for a building that wastes energy? How does that possibly make sense? And how at all can you call that cost effective? So maybe it's my impatience, or maybe it's my grumpiness, but I'm at the point now that you can't afford not to build a green building. And it's just silly not to. And this is furthered by the fact that always around the midpoint of every semester, the students always say, I don't understand. Why aren't all buildings built this way? And then I know that I've gotten through to them because they understand the argument. And unfortunately, I don't have an answer for them. I say, I don't know. What do you think? And we come up with series of conspiracy theories of all sorts of things, and we come up with ideas of tradition, things like that. But in truth, it's really about changing your thinking. By the way, this chart, 10 years ago, a green building would have averaged about 7% more, 5 years ago about 5% more, and today it's really the same price. All of this not including the fact that the green building will probably produce its own energy, save its own water, not waste the energy it does use, make people happier, on and on and on. So how do you then sell these ideas to your clients? Well, I'm going to give you 10 quick steps of how we do it, just so you can see the way to think about these things. The first one is that you stress the lifecycle cost rather than the upfront cost. So when people say, well, how much are solar panels? We just go, oh, those are free. And I go, what? I go, yeah, in about 6 years, they'll be free. Upfront, they're going to cost you about $22,000. But given your energy usage, 6 years, 5 months, 9 days, they'll be free. And those, yeah, look at you. Yeah, exactly. And again, this issue of cost and focusing on the upfront cost just seems so strange, given the value that you're getting. The second way is that you stress the environmental benefits. And the reason I bring this up front is because this is actually the lamest, weakest, most pathetic argument you can make to people. We did this for 30 years. Environmentalists for 30 years said, Mother Nature's dying. The Earth is dying. Someone do something. And people said, yeah, I'll get right back to you. And it didn't work. So if you notice, for the last 5 years, we've been making the business case for environmentalism. And luckily, there's so many benefits that this becomes our backup. This is after the client's already decided on the green floor or the green paint, that they then use this to make themselves feel better. And even the most staunch anti-environmentalist client, after they get, let's say, a cork floor in their kitchen, they invite their guests over and they go, see this floor? No trees were harmed in this. It's all bark. It's just bark. It's all cork. Look how cool I am. Like that. That's really, it's fun to watch. The next way is we stress the social benefits, and luckily these are quite numerous. They found, well, this is a Harvard school. They found that when students take the SAT in a room with natural light, that the scores go up 14%. And you're all thinking, where did my kid take the SAT? they also find worker productivity goes up almost the same amount. They find that people call out sick less often. And if you really think about it, if you're building a building, if you're a corporation, you're going to spend much more on the employees in the building than you certainly did on your architect's fees and your construction. So which is of more value to you? The happiness of the tenants? And I'm just briefly going over those. The next is to stress the health benefits. About 10 years ago, asthma was the seventh leading chronic illness in children. And today, it's number one. And asthma is caused by indoor air quality. And since we spend 80 to 90% of our time indoors, what do you think is happening to our kids? So suddenly this becomes important. Health is also the number one reason and interest that people have in green building, especially when it comes to their own health. And what we found is there's this effect that I call the CEO syndrome, that CEOs typically ignore all things environmental until they have a daughter that's about 14. And then suddenly, like H. Lee Scott of Walmart, it becomes very important to them. So maybe it's just a matter of time. The next benefit is to stress the performance benefits. And again, these are quite numerous. If you put more windows in the building, then the lights aren't on as much, and you don't have to change the light bulbs as often. It's pretty commonsensical, isn't it? And we can now attribute these to direct bottom line expenses and benefits to the client. Next is to stress the occupant satisfaction benefits. About 5 years ago, Walmart did this study, and they stripped the roof off of a store in Lawrenceville, Kansas, and covered it with skylights. And they did it to save on their electricity bill. And what they found was that sales in the skylight portion were double that of the non-skylight portion. And then the cash registers that extended to the skylight portion rang up twice as many sales as the non-skylight portion. So what did Walmart do? They're putting skylights in all their stores. But we've also seen all these other benefits, especially with worker happiness and satisfaction and employee productivity and longevity, on and on and on. The next three actually have to do with return on investment. The first one is energy savings. Simply just doubling the minimum amount of insulation in the walls will pay for itself in a matter of months. So that's kind of an easy argument to make. Unfortunately, we live in a country where we like to do the bare minimum all the time. And actually, I don't know if you're aware of this, but in the state of California, we actually have energy standards called Title 24 that surpass those around the country. And yet, everybody still does the minimum. So this is kind of an easy thing to do. The next way is to look at the maintenance savings. UC Berkeley did a study, and they found that any investment you make in a green building feature will pay for itself more than 10 times over in the life of the building. Can you think of another investment that does that? Maybe oil, I guess. And the next one, the last return on investment is tax incentives. And luckily, especially here in California, there are numerous on the federal, state, local, and even countywide level. Everything from solar credits to Energy Star credits. And if any of you are interested, I'm happy to email you a list of them. And then the last one is actually my favorite. And this is simply what we call falling in love with the beautiful. And the reason it's my favorite is because it's what we as designers already do. There are some green products that are so beautiful and so evocative and so innovative, things that you've never seen before, that just simply holding them, you're going to want them. And we're not even going to mention the green features. So we'll just place it in front of the client, and they'll go, oh my God, I want it. And then afterwards, after they calm down, then we say, well, you know, it's made of recycled glass, you know, or something like that. And really the point is, why sell the obvious? Why even make it a point? The truth is green material is not tied to beauty, that there's things that you've never, and I brought a few with me, that you've never seen before. So after the lecture, I encourage you to come up and play with our little petting zoo here. So, I don't know if I have time for case studies or not. Yeah? Well, maybe I'll just do one. I'll do one. Oh, this is more than one. This is a house in Bernal Heights. This is an addition. You can see the existing house here. Right? And this is just your standard three-story addition. And it's designed by where the path of the sun is, not by where the neighbors are. And the walls, although we've now changed a bit because of budget, but the walls initially were made out of a material called ICF, insulated concrete forms. It's recycled polystyrene that you stack up as blocks and then fill it with concrete, and it creates this super energy-efficient structural wall. So we've designed it on a module to reduce the amount of cutting. That little shading device is made out of bamboo, and it's a giant breeze LA to reflect the western harsh sun from coming in. There's a giant windscreen, and it's really all about bringing in light in unusual places. The next one that I meant to show you, this one's in Redwood City. The client had asked for, he's kind of eccentric, and he asked for a glass box. And he was joking when he said it, but he said, if I could live in a glass box, I would. So that's what we designed, much to his surprise. And the way we did it was we used a process called curve stitching. And curve stitching is, do you remember the string art of the 70s, 60s and 70s, those things? That's essentially a really cheesy example of curve stitching, where you use straight lines to create these parabolic forms. So first we started with this, kept the existing garage, because it was already there, right? And then did this addition, and then eventually it evolved into that. And even though this is in Redwood City, and even though it gets insanely hot in Redwood City, this building will not require air conditioning, because this is a chimney, and then a spiral staircase goes around and wraps and takes you up to the master suite, and then there's vents around this chimney, and then low windows here. So because of the shape of the building, the wind passes over the building, and it creates a negative pressure and sucks air through the building. And we call that passive cooling. And I didn't invent that. It was invented by Native Americans about, 800 years ago. And then really the one bit of wall we have is the kitchen over here. But all of the rest is just glass. And actually it's not even glass. It's this recycled polycarbonate called 3-Form, which we brought. Something about, shards of broken glass raining down on people that I was afraid of, so we used something shatterproof. And because we know where the sun is every minute of every day, we can control the different translucencies and opacities. But my favorite part of it is that when birds fly overhead, their shadow runs along the floor of the living room. And I think that's pretty cool. So let's see. This part of the presentation could go either way. We could give you the architect's version that I talked to other architects, or I can give you for normal citizens. What should I do? Are there any architects here? Okay, you lost the majority. All right, then we'll go with the normal people. So, being a teacher, I like to assign homework. So these are your next five action steps for you to do when you get home. First one is that you change your thinking about sustainability, and you view it as yet another requirement. And whether it's you buying a car, whether it's buying packaging or food, that you think of it as yet another requirement in terms of, well, what's the cost and what are the other benefits of it? And we look at this in terms of the same way we look at building codes. or the same way we look at shipping constraints, or even when you're printing something, when the printer says, oh, we can't fit anything that size, and we change our way of doing it, we think of the same thing in terms of design. Sustainability is yet another requirement that we need to address. The next is, and this one will surprise you, is you think about everything that comes in and out of your house on a daily basis, weekly basis, and you really look at it, and you do something about it. And whether it's the cleaning products you use, which should be non-toxic, or whether it's the food you bring in, which should be organic, or whether it's even the packaging that you use, which hopefully is your own, that you actually take a hard look at your life and what impact you're having. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, well, you know, the government can certainly do more than that, and big industry certainly is having a much bigger impact on the environment than I am, and I'm a good person and all those other things. And you are. You're certainly good people, certainly smart enough to come here tonight. So, but if you remember, every snowflake in the avalanche pleads not guilty. So now we're talking about being snowflakes again. The next is actually an assignment I give my students, which is to try to go an entire day without throwing anything away. And you can give it away. You can find someone else that'll use it for something else, or you can compost it to make it into fertilizer. Or you can even use this site called FreeCycle and give it away. But don't throw anything away. And you'll see how hard it is and how much for granted you take this notion. Well, just throw it away. Step four, we made it easy. Go to our website, organicarchitect.com, and you can download a whole bunch of free lists of things that you can do in your house. And these aren't kind of hippy-dippy things to do, but they're actually tangible, real things that you can do that you'll see a direct benefit. And then we even have lists for other architects, for contractors, and for homeowners. And then step five, and this is probably the most important, is that this information doesn't stop here, that you should take it with you and tell other people about what you know. That's how change happens. If you just go home and go, well, I don't even remember what he was talking about, then really, then I haven't done any good. And this goes for when you go to work, and tomorrow somebody says, hey, what kind of paper should we order for the copier? Or what kind of coffee should we get? Or should I drive half a block to the store? Maybe I should walk. Even little decisions like that. But just tell other people about what you've learned. So going back to our example from the United Nations, sustainability is developing the needs of the present without sacrificing the needs of our future. How could that apply to you and apply to how you do things? Also, this is one of my favorite quotes. Each snowflake in the avalanche pleads not guilty. And then lastly, Gandhi said that you must be the change you wish to see in the world. And this is actually our company's mission statement. So how can you then envision a change for something better and then do something about it? It's really the only way to live if you really think about it. So I'm going to leave you with a few resources. And the reason I gave you these is because they'll lead to dozens of others. And if you want more, feel free to contact me. But the first one's our website. And we have a list of links and books and all sorts of odd things that you can do. The next is ADPSR. In addition to being the world's worst acronym, it stands for Architects, Designers, and Planners for Social Responsibility. And from that site, you can get a list of all sorts of things. And then lastly, greenhomeguide.com. It's a site for homeowners. It's kind of a consumer reports of green materials. And then if you're interested in more of this notion of cradle to cradle, then you read the book by the same name, Cradle to Cradle. And one interesting note about the book, it's not made of paper. It's made of corn. And when you're done with it, you could technically throw it in your garden and fertilize the soil. So it's an interesting thing to know. So that being said, I'd be thrilled to take any questions that you may have. Or if not, I can talk to you afterwards. So thank you all for listening to me. So. Yes, ma'am?
What got you on
the task? That's a long story. Well, it started when I was 8. And I used to draw pictures of buildings all the time. And the only buildings that I really liked were those of Frank Lloyd Wright. And by the time I was 17, I was writing away to his former students. And by the time I was 22, I was working for them. And there was always this inherent connection to nature. And we didn't have green building. Nobody called it that. So it was always presented to me as a very logical way of doing things. Also a very romantic way of doing things too. But as you'll find, most things logical are also very romantic. And most things romantic are also very logical. So of course we're going to orient the building to the sun. And of course we're going to use natural materials. And of course we're going to try to get fresh air instead of canned air. And why wouldn't we? You know? And that was kind of drilled into me at a very early age. So that got me into it. And then formally it started, I guess, while I was in school. And I went to an East Coast school, like I guess most of you did, and was considered kind of the outcast of the school because of it. And people said, oh, you're wasting your time on this environmental stuff. But at that point, it was the late 80s, and apparently nobody really thought anything about energy use at that point. But I was lucky to find mentors that did believe in it. Yes, ma'am?
Well, my name is Leah Taslov, and I'm a Harvard undergrad, and I'm a feng shui practitioner. So we were speaking beforehand a little, but what intrigued me a lot was when you talked about how everything has an inherent energy in it, and that's very much what we talk about in feng shui. Everything has chi. Everything's alive. Whether or not it actually grew out of the ground or not, it still has that inherent energy. There's definite parallels there. And I was just curious with the example that you showed with, leaning towards the sun, the Merle Height one. Do you ever do any of the balancing of the elements now that you're actually coming in even more to them themselves, sort of like baked concrete or whatever, your example? Do you guys ever think about it?
We think about it, but not in probably the way that you think about it. We don't use the bagua or any of that.
The elements are for people to think about their water, fire, wood, metal, and earth.
Right.
In the feng shui.
So, I think about it in a very different way, but my other feng shui friends have said that there's an inherent feng shui-ness to a lot of good design. And then earlier we were talking about Vastu, which is the Indian feng shui, and then we have a Vastu consultant on one of our projects, and she was saying, oh, your buildings are very Vastu compliant. I was like, okay. Okay. Thank you. Like, I didn't know what to say, but it kind of makes sense. And actually, I've had this idea for a book, and maybe one of you guys can write it. But it was taking buildings of history. Specifically, I was thinking of Monticello as kind of my first one, and maybe even the Pantheon, and then doing a feng shui analysis on them and seeing how they hold up.
The triangle of three foot shape. Power,
so to me, I always thought that'd be a great book, but I'm not skilled enough to write. You could write it. Oh, great. Yes, sir.
The way you describe this whole world of green architecture, the conclusion is, well, it's obvious everybody should do this, and it makes great sense in a whole lot of different ways, including financial way. And so the question is, why isn't that happening? What are the barriers that you see, whether legal or financial or societal or otherwise, to this happening?
I think there's several. I think there's probably also several more that I'm unaware of. I think the first is tradition. Construction tends to be very risk adverse. Specifically developers and contractors. Developers have a very formulaic approach to designing buildings. They're influenced more by market analysis rather than design. And when you say to them things like, well, let's not build out of 2x4s, let's build out of this because it's got these benefits, they're very scared of it. And a full third of my time is spent trying to teach developers and other architects how to be more green. The other way is, if you think about it, we've been building out of what we call stick framing for 175 years. And as far as we're concerned, that's an eternity. We really can't see much past our own generation. I also think that an entire generation of architects has come up really disconnected to the site. When you look at these glass skyscrapers that they build in Houston, where the north side and the south side are identical, and they're made of glass, and Houston's quite hot. As soon as you see that, to me, I always laugh at those things, but I guess the tenants probably aren't laughing. And I know for a fact that the mechanical engineers designed the air conditioning system to be double the size on the south and west side because of the solar heat gain that it's getting all day, and then the north side is getting much less. And the mechanical engineer, of course, never thinks to say, hey, maybe you shouldn't do that, because you should never question the architect. And so there's also things like that, too. I think it's maybe it's a bit of like a fog of war, in that we're just all kind of racing to get these things built and done, and we're not stopping to question them. You know, I often hear from architects, well, the budget's already so tight as it is, we don't have time to even explore these other things. And it's a bit of a chicken and egg syndrome, in that they want to do these things, but they don't have the time, but they really should be doing them, but if they only took the time, then they could do that, on and on and on. So that's kind of been the wonderful success of U.S. Green Building Council's LEED rating system. It's this green building rating system. People can just point to it and say, here, just do these things, and it'll make the building green. And that's probably the reason why it's taken off so much as it has. So, yes, sir.
It seems to me that green building is largely based on materials that require a lot of energy to produce, whether it's recycled materials or creating from scratch. Do you think, or and transport them, a lot of the percentage we produce, do you think that ultimately green building is a dead end and we should be focusing more on natural buildings?
What do you think the difference is between green building and natural building?
Green buildings seem to be technological solutions for more efficient systems, and natural building would be working with nature and natural materials from the start. Materials that wouldn't have to be assembled or manufactured.
Great question.
It seems like a lot of people who are opponents of green building are people who are practicing it. I'm studying to be an architect, so it almost seems that pushing natural building would be empowering people, like kind of putting themselves out of the job.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Well, you know, having built several buildings out of straw bale and adobe and rammed earth and pumicecrete, and built a house out of tires once, called an earthship, and a lot of them were owner built, where the owner gets a bunch of friends and a bunch of beer and pizza and says, stack them up kind of thing. You're right. Natural building would be an obvious choice. I think I'm more excited by not one or the other, but the something else. I think I'm more excited by the green prefab technologies. I think I'm more excited by the mass production technologies that are green and don't have a lot of embodied energy into them. And by their very nature, prefab reduces waste because they're building the same thing over and over again, and they save every bit of scrap. So there's a lot of things like that that I think are quite exciting. That isn't one, it's not the other, it's something else. And also there are a lot of natural building techniques that don't work for things like skyscrapers or museums, things like that. So it'd be really hard to pull off saying to a client, listen, let's build your shopping mall out of straw bale. We can't go over one story with it, and the walls are going to be three times as thick as what you've expected, and real estate's at a premium. So surely there must be something else. And what's exciting is that people like you are going to come and invent that for us. So get on that right away. Yes, sir.
Could you give us some examples of the green prefab that could be used in three-story buildings?
Well, apparently, Michelle Kaufman's Glide House, she's had success up to five stories with her beautiful little module. And really, she... Yeah, glidehouse.com. GLIDEHOUSE. And what's interesting about that is really you just assemble it in just infinite variety of ways. And what I find myself saying, kind of like his question, is that what do they need us for? You know, I mean, we've had clients that we've referred to Michelle because it's clear that they just need a prefab house, and really, there's no need for us. And again, that's not a great business model, but to me, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, architecture is inherently damaging to the planet, right? So then, how do you justify that? So I don't know, it's tough. But again, you're going to solve that for us. I'm excited. Hey, everybody's doing it. Yes, sir, in the back.
Is there a reverse incentive that needed to support the citizens of that professional interest in architecture? Would work to change? I mean, Well, it's just looking at the natural path that we're walking down by everything that follows the, you know, our conversation rates are calculated, blah, 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 blah. So are there things that are currently embodied in the construction system in the United States that are grasped upon, I don't know, make up a verb of reunification
Well, it's funny that you're standing there because right in front of you is the woman in charge of the city of San Francisco's project to do that. So, you could ask her about what the city's been doing. Laura Engel, give a bow.
I'm more involved in the city of San Francisco, and I run the commercial green building program. And right now, in San Francisco, we have a requirement that municipal buildings have to be green, and they have to meet certain standards for green. In the commercial sector, we're working on priority permitting. So what that would mean is that currently, a new building that comes into the planning department, it takes anywhere from 6 to 9 to 12 months to get through the kind of planner, and we're hoping to write that down to 2 weeks. So you have to come in with what's called a LEED Gold building, so it's a fairly high standard of green building. We had a big meeting about it today, and we met with the attorneys, and everything looks good. I think that it's going to happen. We just don't know exactly when it will be launched. And ultimately, I think down the road, we'll probably put together an ordinance in the city that requires green buildings. So, you know, as Eric was saying, it's going to be really expected. Residential, there's no requirement for green in the city right now. Nor do we have that requirement. We're thinking about green resolution to encourage green building, but we have no requirement at this time that the under city considered by our Department of the Environment, Department of Building Inspection, and the Planning Department.
Thanks.
Go back a couple of questions. Will we influence our local government?
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting point, because one of the issues that came up today with the attorneys is we may have to go to the board supervisors for approval for the priority funding, because students are such a huge financial advantage to bump somebody up from a year down to 2 weeks. We're going to institute some kind of financial mechanism or financial assistance as well, allegations. And it might have to go through the supervisors. Right now, the people, Mayor Newsom, is really in favor of green buildings. And you know, with our, the breakup of our, not breakup, but mid-up of our board supervisors. They learn the areas of it, and some of them don't. And so, it's easy to capture your supervisors and try to encourage them about green buildings, even if they don't like them there. That would be really good. So, and that is, I think,
well, I also strongly encourage you to essentially you're voting every time you make a purchase of anything. So vote with your dollar in the correct way. But even more to the point that look at the way your office is run, look at the way your house is run, and make decisions that way. And again, like I said, tell other people about it. That's probably the most important thing you can do. Yes.
I just to add to that, I might also recommend that, you know, we could influence Harvard's design building, because if you see what's going on there, you know, the university is doing an excellent job. That 12 LEED rated projects going on, they're requiring LEED for all the new buildings. They're looking at creek daylighting and the development across the river. But the architecture program itself isn't teaching green building at all. And it actually came up at the same building conference there as a disconnect. And it was recognized by a lot of people there that the people graduating from Harvard Architecture School probably can't meet the criteria of part of the Harvard requirements. That's probably a good group to encourage the architecture department to get that together, because they're way behind because they can afford to be much longer. And,
yes, sir.
You know, there's a lot of money coming out.
What about stores like Home Depot, Lowe's, do you go, and Whole Foods has kind of influence on Safeway and other stores. Is there a Whole Foods, or is there something coming down the road where we'll be able to say, I want to be parked at my place, and there's a green choice that you can find?
Yes. The irony in your question is that any big box retail, by its very nature, is not green. So these stores that I'm about to tell you are small, but that's part of the sustainability aspect. But here in the Bay Area, there are three worth mentioning. The first one is Green Fusion Design Center in San Anselmo. Just Google them. Green Fusion Design Center. The second one is Eco Home Improvement in Berkeley. And the third one is Eco Design Resources in San Carlos. So you have all, you know, all three counties. Yes, ma'am.
And also, in San Francisco, Food Build a Green website, there are vendors in the
city that
can find green materials. So buildagreen.org. And then there's Access Green, the database, and it highlights green materials, and then it'll show you which supplier or hardware store vendor sells those green products in San Francisco and in the greater Bay Area.
And the ADPSR also has a green materials showcase that they, I think, they're doing twice a year.
No, we're only doing once a year. But in September, nice segue, because this September, the ADPSR Green Material Showcase has morphed into a commercial, gigantic conference called West Coast Green, and I brought a bunch of flyers for you to take. And it's September 28th to the 30th at the Bill Graham Civic, westcoastgreen.com, or just take a flyer. And LEED is an acronym for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. It was produced by the U.S. Green Building Council in 99, I believe. And essentially, it's a checklist that you use to rate the greenness of your building. And they have four tiers. They have just plain old certified, and then they have silver, gold, and then platinum. Platinum being, of course, the best. The city's requirement, as Laura was explaining, is that all municipal buildings will now be LEED Silver as a minimum. And this preferred permitting would be LEED Gold as a minimum. So it's a pretty ambitious program. And kudos to the city for not just taking the baseline plain old certified. Just to give you some idea of the growth of LEED in the last 5 years, there are now more than 25,000 LEED accredited professionals, people that have been trained in this rating system and how to use it. There have been 3,000 buildings that have been certified or on their path to being certified so far, and the curve is going upward. So I've worked on 5 of those, which is a fairly good amount, I think, for one firm to do. So essentially, it's not things that would be that unusual. And what's really funny about it is that just building a building in the state of California, because of our kind of fairly stringent energy requirements of Title 24, you're more than halfway to getting certified anyway. So there's really no reason not to even just get the basic certification. So, yes, ma'am. Well, your pleas will probably fall on deaf ears to the federal administration, but I would certainly target Schwarzenegger and whoever's governor after him to focus more on it. There would be many more subsidies at the state level than federal level, but there are federal incentives. And if anybody wants them, I'm happy to email them to you later. But But I think really it's a matter of asking for them. In California, we just passed this Million Solar Roofs initiative, which will kind of guarantee support for a lot of that. And the kind of irony of putting solar on your house is that the payback is really dependent on how much electricity you consume. The more you consume, the faster it'll pay for itself. So if you're paying, you know, if you're paying $35 a month to PG&E, you're probably not a good candidate for solar. But if you, you know, have got 12 computers running all the time and TVs and stereos and microwaves and you probably leave the refrigerator door open to keep yourself cool, you're probably a really good candidate for solar. So we see the payback go anywhere from as low as 5 years to up to 25 for some people. And then there's things other than solar too. There are these new micro wind turbines that for $600 are small enough to put on a house. The trouble with those is that a lot of local municipalities find them ugly, so the neighbors complain. But not much you can do about that. Yes, ma'am?
I just did a program with Transition, and I'm really excited about the sustainability. And I'm not exactly quite sure where I should go next. Who should I talk to? Who should I work for? What school should I be looking at? If you have a hot spot,
You're sitting in the hospital.
I'm here. I'm
as
a student of the commission.
Oh, I go into law. I receive about on average 2 emails a day from people like you that say, I'm a young architect, or I'm just a young student, or actually we've been getting a lot of these kind of 35-year-old people that say, I feel like I've wasted the last 15 years of my life and I want to do something that combines my values and what I do for a living. And so, you know, I'm fortunate that I get to see this major wave of people that are trying to change. And I offer to meet with all of them, and my days are pretty much filled up with those kinds of meetings. So the short answer would be you and I should probably just chat about it. The kind of easier answer for everybody to hear is start with the websites that I gave. You know, the reason I gave them is because they link to so many others. And San Francisco actually is the capital of green building, and then we're seeing surges in hubs such as Austin and Chicago, certainly, and New York and Scottsdale and Portland and Seattle and all the usual suspects. So that's probably the best place to start, I would imagine. Yes, sir.
I'm wondering, is there any radiance to the sewers that can help sort of understand what shaded green products are, as well as architects or builders, etc.? And tie into that, there is also, I was just reading an article out of the comments this week, about the whole market that's emerged for offsets, basically for consumers or producers, which is expensive for them to comply. They can basically buy offsets and something else from the panel to keep their lobby boards and sell them.
What you're mentioning is there's now this thing called the Chicago Climate Exchange, which started a few years ago, and companies can now buy carbon offset credits to offset their carbon emissions that they're inevitably going to put in the air. And the way they do it is they buy it from companies that are reducing their carbon emission footprint. But even on a consumer level, you can buy what's called a TerraPass for your car if you go to TerraPass.com. And essentially you're buying, you put in the make and model of your car and how many miles you drive every year, and you purchase carbon offsets for the amount that you drive. And really, it's all you really end up getting is a sticker. But in reality, what you're doing is you're making a statement about your commitment to what you're bringing into the world and taking some responsibility for what you're doing. In answer to the first part of your question, there are a lot of consumer rating systems. The thing is that they tend to be centered around specific types of products. So let's see. There's for wood, there's this thing called FSC, Forest Stewardship Council, which certifies sustainably harvested wood. For carpet, there's Green Guard. Who is it? Yeah, Green Guard, which certifies kind of more flooring products more focused on that. And the reason that these various different things have come up is because a lot of manufacturers found, well, it's hard to rate a floor the same way that you rate a paint. So these disparate little rating systems have sprung up. The ones that are recognized, like Energy Star, that's kind of a common one. I'm sure in your home somewhere you have an Energy Star rated appliance. That would be kind of the most common one. But again, that's focused on energy use, not really on material use. So if you want a list, I'm happy to send it to you. But it's unfortunately still very confusing. It's very kind of nascent thing so far.
Are the LEED ratings, are there specifications that are laid out like gold, silver, so they're
No. The LEED rating system doesn't, the LEED doesn't certify products. It certifies the overall building as a system. And it does it by, there's a maximum number of points you can achieve, and you rack up points, and depending on the number of points you get, determines what level. But it doesn't certify products. They've been very careful to avoid being endorsers of a specific product. They're really looking at the overall system, and if you go to the OSGBC's website, you can download the thing for free and take a look at it, and it's really quite clever how they did it. They broke it into water use, energy use, material use.
But when you're looking at it and versus someone else looking at it, it's the same valuation. For example, if I'm in real estate, and I can get a valuation of a house, and I'm allowing to get another valuation of a house,
there's no subjectivity to LEED as there would be in a real estate valuation, to be sure. And that's another good topic. Bill DeGreen is now has established what they call a real estate council. And this real estate council is trying to introduce on your MLS listing some value for a green building to increase the valuation of a green building here in the state of California. And if you go to buildagreen.org, you can read more about that. It's really quite clever. And the ideas would just be another line on the MLS. So when you're buying a house, the realtor can say, see, this one's all toxic materials, this one's all toxic. Oh, see, this one's all green. And then that way you can make a much more informed decision about where you're going to live. So, yes, sir?
It's important to consider green materials similar to, say, organic foods and alternative when they were much more expensive than they are now, and it was up to the responsible citizen to kind of jumpstart that in the market. And it's fairly similar for a good range of green materials as well, being a commercial residential. And what you're seeing is that some materials are fairly exotic and overpriced and more kind of lumpy and kind of pushed off the edge of the produce style of the material level have now kind of trickling their way into front of the building and have to spray them off every 30 minutes to add a whole to the market. Therefore, being that it's our responsibility as enlightened purchasers to keep pushing that black organic so that it starts moving to other parts of the country as well.
And also in terms of personal
consumption,
kind of awkward, the most important
decision you make as a personal consumer is what?
Are you asking me?
You're a
biker, aren't you?
Yes. What is the second most important thing to make? It's not arguing to your boss that they want to keep them building, but it is. It's what you eat. So, yes, materials are important, and we as an architect have a job to do. Use what you can do every day, as you mentioned in your presentation. It's what you drive, and you're right, it's what you eat. You have the acting, you need to make sure it's organic. Those are two things you can think about.
Well, we're out of time, so if you have any other questions, I'm happy to answer them up front here. But otherwise, please take a look at our little petting zoo, and thank you all. For